This is Monocle on Design, a show where we unpack everything from architecture and craft to furniture and fashion. I'm Nick Manise. On today's program, it's a London special as we look to the UK capital for excellence and inspiration. We celebrate the 10th anniversary of cult fashion shop Machine A. We learn how material choice is key when it comes to inclusive design. And we meet Marco Campardo, this year's winner of the Ralph Saltzman Prize. All that coming up on Monocle on Design. In London's Soho district, Machine A celebrates its 10th anniversary this year. The clothing shop became a hub for those seeking out emerging graduate designers and established names too. Here, they're stocked side by side. Machine A founder Stavros Karelis joined Monocle's fashion editor Natalie Theodosi in our studios to reflect on his journey to date and the importance of his neighbourhood of Soho. Natalie began by asking what made Stavros open the space in the first place.
I want to create a space where young talent and emerging talent and young creatives could coexist, and actually creating something that I was feeling at that point was missing in the market and the retail landscape as it was at that point. I moved in London to do my master's degree, and then I think as everyone in those early stages, in early 20s, I used to go out quite a lot and do a lot of clubbing. And then this is where I met really incredible, you know, young fashion designers, or they were still students in universities and colleges, and they would be wearing the things that they're designing. So my natural question was like, where can I find what you're wearing? They were saying, well, there is no place that is selling our clothes. So this is more or less where, in a very raw way, the idea was created in my mind. But of course, you know, opening a retail was a completely different experience after that.
And like you say, you have been such a champion of young design talent. And I'm curious, is that customer that wants those one-of-a-kind pieces, they are interested in discovering pieces by designers that are lesser known, is that appetite still there? And does that customer still exist 10 years later? Or is it maybe it has grown?
Absolutely. I mean, the fact that we have survived those 10 years and we have evolved as a business, it proves that there is a customer there for this. I think it's such an important part of the future of fashion. When you are working so closely with young talents or emerging talents, what is very special about it is that you see you're growing together. And because, as I said, you know, they will be the future of fashion. They will be the designers that everyone's going to be talking in the next few years. The sooner the people are connecting with them, the better, you know, they feel, because they feel that they're part of the DNA of the brand and also part of the DNA of the store, that they can discover those designers. I also feel, you know, this is a great point of difference, if I may say, because with a lot of brands, you know, there is a kind of, we're sharing, you know, like between different retail stores. And I think more or less, you know, we all know kind of like the exciting brands or the brands that, you know, the big brands that everyone wants like to work with, which is great. But I think a very special point of difference is when you work with like the really young designers, because this is where you can show fully who you are, how you want to curate things, who you believe and who you're backing up. That, at least for Machine A, worked extremely well. And if anything, after 10 years, I feel even stronger about that this is definitely the right way to go.
I'd love to also speak about Soho, because yes, it's such a big part of your journey, right? And then you opened Machine A there before it was what it is today, with all the luxury shops and the restaurants. So tell me why you chose that area, and also how does a neighborhood like Soho play a part in creating the shaping the character of your business and guaranteeing its success?
Yes, I mean, Soho for me is extremely important. It's part of what Machine A is about. 10 years ago, when I was looking for different areas, let's say in London, you know, that we can do the store, it was only Soho that the concept that we were planning to do would have worked. I love Soho because it's fun, and you can see that they have a lot of, at least at that point, had a lot of original still elements, you know, to it, which was much more underground. It was highlighting a lot of cultures, which, you know, I was very much interested in, and I'm still am to this day. And it was very challenging because, you know, when we opened in Soho, as you very well said, it's not what it was. It wasn't what it is today. It wasn't a shopping destination. We opened between two massage spaces, you know, like, and everyone, of course, knew Soho of the place to go and have fun and a good night out. But it wasn't really a shopping destination. We opened the same year with Supreme, you know, like, and then I think after a year or so, Palace opened, you know, like in the same street with us. That created immediately a new way of customers, you know, to come and explore a new neighborhood, you know, in terms of retail, in terms of shopping. And of course, since then, you have, you know, great stores like Dover Street Market, you know, that move very close by. And then the whole street and the whole area has this, at this stage, you know, developed to become a proper shopping destination. I'm very glad that I'm still there today, you know, because, you know, the store and the business has kind of like outgrown the size of us, you know, like, so it was always a question if we were looking for a new space, you know, whether we're going to remain in the same area or not. And thankfully, with a bit of luck, you know, we managed to take the space next door from us. So we're expanding the business that way. And we are at this stage currently, as we talk, you know, we're refurbishing our store, which is going to open end of this month, early April. And I'm really happy that we are part of this retail journey of Soho, which worked really, really well and works still to this day very well to everything that we want to show through our store.
Yeah. I feel Machine A is just such an institution in Soho, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's very funny because when we first opened the store, there were two key elements, you know, that we presented through our store in terms of, let's say, visual merchandising and the way that we wanted to say the story for the designers and the brands we stock. It was always shown in a very gender fluid way. We never separated men's sections to women's sections, you know, like in the store. And we always mixed the brands on the same rail. So you could see very high-end brands, you know, from Margiela and Ralph Simons and Rick Owens, etc., you know, next to a student and a graduate. And for me, that was the best way of showing, because I thought that this is how everyone I know of, including me, are shopping basically to this day. But it was a much more complex discussion that I was having with the brands, you know, like about this, because it was very new at that point, you know. But I'm very glad that everyone has accepted us in that way, and now actually they're embracing it and they're very happy that we managed to do that. And I think, again, you know, Soho was the right environment, you know, for us to be able to play with all these different ways of retail experience.
And here on this show, we also speak a lot about retail design and how yes. you think about interiors to maximize customer experience and how you display your products. So tell me, especially now that you are extending the space and doing your refurbishment, what role does that play in creating the Machine A experience, and how have you been thinking about the design and the interiors?
Yeah, I mean, initially when we first opened the store, I mean, for whoever has been in our actually physical store, it's very almost like a blank canvas, you know, like, and it was made on purpose back in the day that in that sense when we're designing it, because for me it was very important to give the central stage, you know, to the clothes and not have anything taken away from them. So we created like this great way of showing, you know, with like different semicircular structures, you know, that it's very much of, again, a stripped out way, but a much more evolved from what Machine A used to be before. There are going to be some central key elements of quite a lot of heavy structures of concrete, let's say, you know, like, and I think it's going to be quite exciting for everyone to see how this is going to translate now in London, because the idea of how we do the interior of London came actually from the designs of the Shanghai store. We want to create a journey, a customer journey within the store, that it's always very important to me that the customer that walks in the store feels at ease, you know, like they don't feel that they walk into something so perfectly done that they're afraid to touch a cloth, you know, like that they're afraid to touch something from the hanger and try it on. I want people, you know, to feel free to hang out, to talk, to engage with everyone inside the store, and to feel free, you know, to try clothes on, to play with it. You know, like I don't like the... I'm not very fond of spaces that it's so perfectly done that you're so... It's almost looking like a gallery space, because that's not what it is. It's actually people have to walk in and have fun with it. So hopefully they will have fun with it.
Looking ahead into the next decade, what do you foresee for Machine A and also for physical retail? Because that's an ongoing question of what the future of physical shopping looks like.
Yeah, I always thought that retail is absolutely important, you know, to the, you know, when you have a company like this. I mean, I know the debate, you know, between the online, the physical, et cetera, et cetera. And for me, it's not really a debate of one or the other. It's actually both of them, you know, have to coexist. And you creating a hybrid in many, many ways to be able to showcase what you want to do. Retail is offering you something that, at least at this stage, the online cannot offer, which is this physical interaction with all the people. You know, people walk into a store and they know who you are, what you do. They can have a conversation with you, but you also know them and know who they are and what they do. It's a place of gathering and is a place of exchange of ideas. When I think of Machine A and I think of the future of it, I would like to be able, you know, to do culturally, what we managed to do in London these years, to be able to perhaps, you know, do that in different cities in the world. And what I mean by that is that maybe perhaps, you know, opening, you know, a few more physical retail spaces in some key cities that I consider perhaps key cities, and how we interact with, you know, the local universities, the designers, the young emerging talent there, and how we create these different type of bridges between those different type of cities. And it's all about the culture exchange, but also experimentation and highlighting, you know, important cultures that are connected with each one of those cities. So that would be my ideal scenario for the next, like, 10 years of development of Machine A. But as they say, you know, when you do plans, you know, someone might laugh about this. So I'm really grateful to where I am today. You know, all these 10 years, if you ask me in the beginning, I never thought that we would be here where we are today. I never dreamt that far or that long. I thought what is happening in the next few years of the business. Right now, of course, because we are part of a great group, you know, Tomorrow Group, that we are partners since 2020. Of course, you know, it's a lot of growth that goes into the business, and I'm extremely excited about what next years are going to bring. But also, I like the fact that we can be agile and easily to be able, you know, to adjust our plans based on what is happening at the world at any single time.
Stavros Karelis, founder of Machine A there, in conversation with Monocle's fashion editor, Natalie Theodosi. Designing inclusive spaces is an important goal for any designer. But how does this play out in reality? The London LGBTQ+ Community Centre is one venue that had that aspect baked into its brief. Since starting out as a pop-up in 2021, the Community Centre has since been granted permission to become a permanent space. In both iterations, a key tenet in its design had been ensuring that patrons feel welcome. To understand how choices in materials are important in this project, Monocle's Andre Nikolai Pamintuan visited the Buzzing Creative Hub to meet the architect Martha Summers, who designed the space. Martha began by explaining why, as part of her practice, she often questions design norms.
It's kind of about like a queer way of working. It's about leaving everything that they sort of taught you or indoctrinated you to think at architecture school at the door, and instead taking almost like your life experiences and your queerness and I guess the methods with which like queer people self-fashion and almost using that more as a set of design tools. I have this like working methodology of doing this sort of queer appraisal of a space, like looking at it and trying to find like the cracks, the inconsistency, the moments where the kind of like design dogma kind of like starts to break down, where kind of reality and the dirt and mess of real life have started to kind of creep through already.
So Martha, tell us about the space and how you utilize the fixtures or elements already existing here.
The space itself, it's kind of like a big rectangular room. And it has these areas of glazing, which are kind of amazing. You can see like across the river to St. Paul's. What I think is really nice is because it's right on the Thames, it kind of feels like you're connected to South and North London at the same time. Out of one window, you can look to the south, the other, you can look to the north over the river. The space is lined in this aluminium slat wall, which is a leftover from the shop. On the one hand, it's like, it would have been far too expensive and time-consuming for us to get rid of in 2021. But I also, personally, looking at it, was like, this is such a good example of a material that most designers and architects would be like, oh, this is like so like off-trend, it's so dated, it's so like 90s, you know, we should like rip it out and put in some kind of whitewashed timber or something. I'm very interested in, I guess, how having like an almost like gender non-conforming lens on beauty, or I'm like very interested in things that people deem as ugly or unnatural and where that codifying is coming from, or especially this term that architects love to use about like honest materials, because I find it like incredibly questionable, like at what point a material is like honest or dishonest.
I understand that the main ambition of the space is flexibility, wherein you wanted a feeling of not being too fixed or being too designed. So could you tell me more about the process of conceptualizing the space?
The key thing was finding the right balance between a space that feels kind of a bit chic and over-designed, because I think that can often feel a bit inaccessible. When you're talking about like designing for communities, whatever that community may be, a community is always intersectional, you know. So if you're designing for the queer community, you're designing for a whole range of people from different class backgrounds, different races. There's kind of like not going to be one way of approaching that is going to feel welcoming to everyone if you go for a very kind of like top-down approach to design. But equally, if you go to the other end of the spectrum and you make it like completely DIY, like chaos, things can feel often maybe like they aren't given the amount of like care and attention that, you know, a community can deserve.
For many queer people, there's this visceral need to belong. Is this something that came into play in terms of making sure that the elements or configuration ensured a feeling of safety?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky thing in terms of like a design approach, because I hesitate to kind of believe that like designers have this kind of like incredible power to like operate outside of capitalism or something. Like, there's only so much you can do as a designer. When I work on community projects in particular, the way that I think about it is that you are creating an apparatus, basically. Then it's kind of up to the community to do the rest. But what that apparatus is extremely important.
Perhaps there's like a certain amount of care that was put in by queer people in terms of making this space?
I think a big thing is that being determined that the space would be built entirely by queer people made it feel like this kind of lovely community project that was like for the community, it was built by the community. Coming onto site during that time was even like a very healing experience for me. I'm a very visibly queer person, and my day job as an architect, I'm like primarily working with like cis het people, and you are not often treated kind of equally when you're on a construction site. So it was really nice to have this experience of kind of like everyone working together with so much that kind of just like went unsaid and was unspoken. But yeah, I think there certainly was like this feeling of like going the extra mile, like creating something that is like for your own community and to a certain extent like for yourself.
we were joined by center manager Liv Jenskowski, who talked about inclusive and new ways the center mediates learning for people from diverse backgrounds. An important aspect of the center is that it's a sober space as well. Could you talk more about that and why you folks decide to have this space as a sober space?
The motivation for having a sober space is partly to encourage intergenerational learning and kind of friendships, because lots of people who want to be surrounded by other LGBTQ plus people are not old enough to access alcohol-oriented spaces, bars and clubs. And also for those that are, it's not always the most welcoming or positive first entry point to our community. Having a place to come and learn about your community, meet members of your community that isn't oriented around partying or romantic relationships was quite important. So we are primarily a daytime space. We are open until 8 in the evening and have a lot of evening events, but creating this place where people who feel excluded from the nightlife have a place to be, because a lot of the older generations feel really like they're not welcome in the party scene anymore. More and more young people these days are choosing sobriety anyway.
What do you think makes the center special?
When you walk in, there is this sense of calm for a start, but also it's not really formal, but it's not really dingy. It's a community space, but it doesn't feel like we've been shoved into the basement of some room. And a lot of our meetup groups and support groups particularly say that it's just so rare for them to be in a space that feels like they're welcome. They are supposed to be there rather than tucked away.
This past summer, the team at the center announced that from a pop-up, the space will now stay open for the next 5 years, a testament to its vision of being an integral part of the neighborhood and its communities. For Monocle on Design, this is Andre Nikolai Pamintuan.
We finish our trio of London stories today by heading to the south of the city. Here, we meet Marco Campato, winner of this year's Ralph Saltzman Prize, an award for industrial design innovation. He was chosen for his process-driven instincts. The furniture maker often uses industrial production methods as a starting point and looks for ways to subvert or hack them. Whether producing an installation for department store Selfridges using sugar and expanded clay, or working with wood veneer specialist Alpi to produce furniture from discarded waste, Marco's radical approach is not driven by aesthetic or recurring use of a certain material. To find out more, our producer Maile Evans visited his studio.
When I was a child, I spent a lot of time with my brother and my dad doing our DIY projects. During the university, perhaps I was underestimating, you know, the idea of making things. I was more fascinating about this intellectual work of being a graphic designer. And then little by little, I started to do like a stool or some experiments. Then I understood that instead of being a whim, it was like something that I was looking for next to graphic design. I'm trying now to connect the dots, but I think it's related with the fact that now I'm more interested with furniture and product is because of my childhood with my dad and the university. My first project, like a collection, we can say, is the George collection that I did in collaboration with Sids Gallery and Alpi. And this project is the result of a collaboration between me and my dad. After visiting the company, we found this technique, cross-laminating wood. While they're producing the veneer wood, there is always like a certain amount of material they are not able to use. So by gluing them together, I'm able to reclaim the wood that otherwise would be impossible to use for the production of the veneer wood. Every layer is a different essence pattern of what remains from a big block of wood. And now we are able basically to produce wooden boards by gluing them together with a specific technique that makes like the board stable. I was like visiting them and I went to this room full of, you know, different samples, from 50 years old, and all the greatest designers, they did something for them. So I was like saying, okay, what should I add on top of that? And then I discovered a warehouse in which they're, you know, collecting all the waste, and I found a solution in recycling instead of designing a new pattern. My pattern was the process, not the design. My style is process-driven. If you understand the process, then you can connect the dots between different projects. But if you just think about the aesthetic, then you might be confused or not able to connect in them. But they are strongly connected because of the process.
Do you have any particular like form or outcome in mind, or is it you're just seeing where it leads you?
Sometimes you have to do like making for a living, or, and you do like what is people are asking for. But especially with the research I'm doing with my studio, I often start with by analyzing the material that I would like to use and a forming process. And most of the time, the process is giving me the final aesthetic of the object.
And a lot of your work seems to stem from this reuse, what would have been waste materials, and actually finding new ways of working with them.
The fact that I'm trying to develop my own materials, it's a way for me to define my identity and my perspective. Every time I'm trying to introduce like a hacking, like an industrial process, or finding like a different material, it's just a way to define my identity. Sometimes it's just a pure provocation. For example, the installation that I did for Selfridges is made of sugar and expanding clay. I call it provocation because sustainability is also about the context in which you are operating. And in that case, I was doing a shop window, and shop windows are temporary installations. So a provocation in the sense of, why should I use like a virgin material to do an installation that is going to endure for 2 months if I can do something that is reversible? And that's the title of the installation, Reversible. I was inspired by this book that is called Cradle to Cradle. And that gave me the idea of doing something that instead of using a classic binder like, you know, an epoxy resin, for example, I've used substitute epoxy resin with sugar. And that allows me to dissolve the sugar after the installation for the shop window and get back to its original state, the material. This is an expanding clay bonding together with sugar. Of course, this is like a provocation, so I'm not pretending to introduce in the market a product that is entirely made of sugar. This is just 4 or 5% of the total amount of material that you need to create the displays for the shop window. But somehow it's just a way to shake, to see if they can find a more sustainable way of conceiving like shop windows.
You mentioned there about the dissolvable nature of sugar, but what makes you interested in working with certain materials? Because they're not maybe the most usual ones that you'd go to.
My approach to design is both like with forming technologies, processes and materials. I'm curious about a specific material, and then I start to think how I can achieve a different way of obtaining an object based on the characteristics of a specific material. You know, through the process, I created my own aesthetic.
Moving forward, what are you looking to experiment with next, be it a certain process or material you're not quite working with now, but maybe in the future could be of interest?
I'm dreaming about to disappear as a designer and create processes in which the object is self-growing. Like if you think about a mushroom, there are like these beautiful videos, accelerated videos, in which you can see this thing just growing. So I would like to find like in the future recipes in which I just, you know, develop the process, the recipe, and then my object will appear from the ground. That is like something that I'm dreaming like every day. I would like to avoid to participate in the final shape. I would like just to give like the push, and then whatever it is, it makes sense because it's part of the process. The beauty of making experiments is the fact that you can make mistakes. And I really like that kind of to experience that freedom somehow, because it reminds me when I was a student or younger, in which you are allowed to make mistakes. Then you become like older, and then you're more afraid to make mistakes, and perhaps that's a limit, because if you're not keen, open to fail in life, then perhaps the outcomes that you're going to obtain are more safe and more obvious. So it's the idea of avant-garde, you know, this military term in which you are in a zone that is not safe, but you are just, you know, there because you want to discover something in a very uncomfortable position somehow. Yeah, but that's the idea. If you allow yourself to make mistakes, then it might be that you're going to discover something different. If you follow the instructions, then the result is obvious, predictable.
Industrial designer Marco Campardo there, in conversation with Maile Evans. An exhibition featuring his work is on show at London's Design Museum until the 3rd of April. And that's all for today's show. For more design stories, listen to our 5-minute midweek bonus show, Monocle on Design Extra, which airs on Thursdays. And if you enjoy print, then do pick up a copy of Monocle magazine as well. It's on all good newsstands now. Today's episode was produced and edited by Maile Evans, with thanks to Lillian Fawcett and Steph Chungu for help in the edit. I'm Nick Manise, and you can reach me on nm@monocle.com. Thanks for listening.